Michael Denzel Smith's last book, Invisible Man, got the whole world watching, was an account of what it means being a young black man in America. In his follow-up, he confronts the well-meaning liberal reaction to the 2016 election and calls on us all to reckon with who we are as Americans and, perhaps more importantly, who we want to be. We have been invested in a set of beliefs about our American identity, our exceptionalism, the inevitable rightness of our path, and the promise that hard work and determination will carry us to freedom. But in his new book, Stakes is High, Michael confronts the shortcomings of these stories and with the American dream itself, and calls on us to live up to the principles we profess but fail to realize. He exposes the stark contradictions at the heart of American life, holding all of us individually and as a nation to account. We've gotten used to looking away, but the fissures and casual violence of incarceration, poverty, misogyny, and racism are ever present. But there is a future that is not as grim as our past. In the new book, Michael helps us envision it, and he does so with care and honesty and imagination. And for all of those reasons and many more, it's a great pleasure to welcome Michael Denzel Smith back to the roundtable. How are you, sir?
I'm doing all right. Thank you for having me.
It's a real pleasure to have you back on the program. I always enjoy our conversations. The book is quite remarkable and is a real gift. Give me the sense of the headspace you were in when you said, okay, this is something I would like to address, and this is how I would like to address it.
Oh, man. You know, after the 2016 election, you know, I was like so many, completely dejected. And then that turned into a depression over time. But I wanted to run away from everything. I just wanted to put my head into a completely different book than what The Stakes is High is. And I started to do that. But even the very first sentence of that book dealt with the 2016 election. And so there, it felt like there was this pull, this responsibility that I was running away from, to really deal with what it was that I was witnessing, what we were all living through, and the prospects of a better future. And so what I had to sit with was what made me so uncomfortable, on election night and the post-election morning of 2016, in terms of the election itself and the results and then people's reactions to it. And what I was realizing is that as for as much as it did, obviously, as we've lived through the past 4 years, signaled this shift towards something that was going to be catastrophic, the entire history of the United States of America has been catastrophic for someone. And, you know, the problem was that people weren't in that moment and then immediately after weren't acknowledging that as much as I think we needed to in order to wrestle with how we got to the election of Donald Trump in 2016. And so I needed to find a way to sit with both the crisis of this moment and the crisis of history. And where I landed as a writer is that, you know, the U.S. has a narrative problem. It's the narrative that we repeat to ourselves about ourselves over and over that leaves us delusional, that leaves us in this state of believing, you know, these very intricate myths that are woven up in our identity that then prevent us from being critical of ourselves as a country, critical of the ideas and then the institutions that are built from those ideas and the application of those ideas and the misapplication of those ideas and the institutions that run roughshod over so many people's lives. We haven't done that work. So I felt, you know, I was making this intervention to say, in order to not repeat the instance of 2016 in which you elect this blowhard, this, you know, out bigot, this, you know, accused sexual assaulter, this white supremacist, all of these things, if you don't want a repeat of that, then you have to reckon with the narrative. And I think, you know, the 2020 election, as we sit and it happened after I finished the book, is one of those things where it's like, you know, we still haven't done that. We think that we've rescued ourselves in this moment, or there are people that think we've rescued ourselves in this moment without acknowledging the deeper roots of these problems.
You write, in the run-up to November 8th, 2016, I heard good liberal white folks promise, or maybe they thought of it as a threat, to move to Canada in the event that Trump won. I would nod politely and think to myself, how quaint, yet another move they plan to hijack from black people. But it must be nice to know there is a place you can go where you will be free. The police create, N-word, in Canada, the same as they do here. I wonder if any of the good liberal white folks thought of any ideas for where we could go to escape. So then we go through 4 years, and it mires us further and further. And I come to you, Michael, wanting to talk about this book, but also wondering, you begin the book by saying what you planned to say when you were working with Democracy Now! On their election coverage into 2016 about Hillary Clinton's victory, ended up talking about Donald Trump's victory. So what should we make of Joe Biden's victory now in election? I guess it's still going on, apparently, but let's say, just for the hell of it, he won. That we, you know, what do you say of how we move forward where the same people that I just read about are trumpeting, at very least, that an African American woman was on the ticket and won?
Yeah, no, I have to wake up every day and say he did win, right?
That happened. Right, exactly. You have to remind yourself.
I think, you know, we have to acknowledge any moment of progress for what it is and then wrestle with what it isn't. So Joe Biden has been elected president of the United States, and in response to 4 years of authoritarian rule of Donald Trump, we're trying to stem that tide, and the election of Joe Biden is one step in that direction. The election of the first both African-American and Indian-American vice president, and a woman no less, is significant in the thing that it can signal symbolically. But the problem is that as U.S. citizens or inhabitants of this country, we get hung up on symbols and we don't get to the core, the policy, the meat of things. What is a Biden-Harris administration going to be doing in the face of the biggest crisis we face in the world right now, climate change, right? What's the actual thing that's the plan there? We see sort of little things rolling out in terms of a response to the economic crisis that particularly has been brought on by the COVID-19 pandemic and thinking about policy changes there. And, you know, one thing that's been thrown out there is student loan relief. And, you know, the first thing was, oh, there will be relief up to $50,000. And then, Joe Biden's talking about, oh, we'll pay off like $10,000, and it's, it's this continual roll back of a policy that's already a little weak, right? And so if these are the gains, the material gains that we get out of this, then we have failed. We have failed to capitalize on this moment in which people have been finally engaged and invigorated to be participants in the democracy. And I think that's the thing that that's a continual mistake that we make, is in believing that the simple machinations of the United States government, of our social institutions, our cultural institutions, simply work if we leave them to quote unquote good people. Well, you hand over all of this power to quote unquote good people without any examination of the ideological underpinnings of those institutions, and you create similar results over and over, and then you make room for the creeping authoritarianism, the creeping white supremacy to be fully expressed. I think there's the thing that I saw that many people saw in those marches right after the inauguration of Trump, where people holding signs that said, if Hillary would have won, I'd be at brunch right now. And, then people sort of like electing Joe Biden and feeling like, well, I could go back to brunch now. And it's not that I don't love brunch, but what I'm saying is that there's has to be a level of engagement. There has to be a level of care to the what actually happens, not just symbolically the transfer of power to something that feels progressive.
You write in the book, there's a whole chapter on accountability, and it's really good. I mean, it's fascinating. But you write a lot about Bill Cosby and Harvey Weinstein and others. What about the accountability of those of what have put us through politically, what we have gone through over the last 4 years?
Yeah, I write about accountability definitely in the in the framework of abolitionism,
right?
Thinking about a world without police and prisons. And I know even some folks who are aligned with me on that, who are like itching for some of the Trump administration to face those exact consequences, to be thrown in prison, to have to suffer in that way. And I understand the impulse, and that's sort of what I'm trying to tease out in the book, is to say, that's an impulse that many of us will have, but what does it serve us going forward if these people that we deem bad are in prison? Do they have to face consequences? Absolutely. And I think, that needs to be teased out. And, I've seen people suggest something along the lines of South Africa's Truth and Reconciliation Commission, just simply the idea that you have to account for what you did. You have to say it publicly. You have to, put it on the record to have the truth out there, and then we can decide from there as a country, what do we do with this? What types of consequences do folks need to face? And look, in the current situation, obviously prison would probably be on the table. But the problem there is that, Joe Biden and his administration are already signaling that they're not interested in any sort of repercussions for the Trump administration. They're interested in this sort of fabled idea of unity. Unity serves no one if what we're attempting to unify are ideologies that are so diametrically opposed that one is meant to bring about the death of people, and one is trying to bring life. Like, there's no middle ground between those two. There's no space in which we should be trying to compromise. And just the idea that the only way toward unity would be to essentially forgive and forget, just act as if the last 4 years had not happened whatsoever, is a mistake. It's a folly. Like, you can't do that. You have to account. And I think that that's been the problem throughout U.S. history, is that we don't account for the past. We think that these are aberrations, that it's just like, a bad person snuck through the system and then abused it. The system itself is one that's abusive, and then to not account for that, and then to not account for those who then further abuse it or use it as a machine for the repression and harm of other people, means that when we move forward, with blinders on, with a map toward the same destination.
We only have about a minute left, but I want to end. You end toward the end of the book. You write, "I am not obviously the first person to ever poke holes in the idea that is the American dream, but no matter how many times you've heard it before, no matter how many times you've heard it critiqued, I believe it bears repeating: the American dream is BS. And it's not BS so much because of its relative unlikelihood, but because it rests on the very idea that inequality is natural and good." how do we get beyond that?
Well, we have to see it as a moral failure. We have to see poverty as a moral failure on the part of the country, not on the part of those who suffer from it. We have to see that these systems that we have set up inequality in such a way that it is, and I think, the pandemic sort of reveals a lot of this, right? Like, how much richer have the billionaires of this country gotten during a global crisis, and how many people have suffered and lost their employment and then have tried to scrape together what they can in a federal government that has not been supportive at all. Mm. You see the cleavages of that. You see the ways in which this, we are stratified as a society, and you think you have to believe that that's not something that's about the character of the people who suffer. It's about the morality of the systems that we have in place, and they are immoral. It is immoral to watch people suffer the way that we have in this country and then to blame them for it. So there has to be a shift in that attitude, and I think that there's a fomenting sort of shift with regards to poor and working class people being able to say we won't stand for this and we will organize for ourselves.
Michael Denzel Smith is the author of Stakes is High, Life After the American Dream. It's published by Bold Type Books. Michael, I can't thank you enough for being on the program. Your words are so important, and I really appreciate you sharing them with us this morning.
Thank you so much. I really appreciate it.
Be well. Thank you. Again, the name of the book, Stakes is High, Life After the American Dream, by Michael Denzel Smith. It is published by Bold Type Books.